Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was continuing her investigation of the American lawn. We resume with Suburban Safari on page 118 with episode 12. Scholars argue over the role of fertilizer in this dynamic. Some say fertilizing the grassland increases its ability to store carbon. Others say the manufacture and shipping of the fertilizer itself puffs more carbon into the air than it's worth. I don't fertilize, but the nagging question remains as to whether my Freedom Lawn stores enough carbon to make up for what's emitted by my lawnmower. I have low hopes, but it's good to know that my yard isn't a complete waste when it comes to climate change. Enough of the grassy savanna. My onward crawl brings me near the spot where the crows were flailing this morning. What I discover is a cool hillside, thriving in the shade of the bamboo wilderness. To find the exact spot where the crows bathed, I look for bent leaves. I find a squashed fall dandelion stem and a few blades of grass that have been mashed against their neighbors. Beyond that, the predominant feature is a carpet of gill over the ground, a plant whose purple-green leaves bear scalloped edges. I look for anthills that the crows might have been raiding, but there are none. Perhaps the crows were exploiting the fall dandelions. I've seen Big Fat Mama, the woodchuck, grasping the tall buds with one black paw and bending them down to her mouth. Is there something special about this plant? I chew a bud myself. It's not as bitter as a normal dandelion. The leaves smell rather mild. Maybe the gill over the ground has something to offer. I crush a leaf and inhale an explosion of odor. The fragrance is like a combination of mint and grass. It's sharp, almost medicinal. To determine the medicinal potential of my weeds, I'm going to need more books. I retreat to the air-conditioned library to gather treatises and histories of herbal medicine. The dandelion does have medicinal uses, I read, but they're related to its diuretic properties. It's recommended for premenstrual syndrome, which makes me wonder if Big Fat Mama hasn't been feeling a little bloated and irritable. The gill over the ground, though, reputedly cures anything that ails me, or a crow. This humble weed is said to possess the qualities of an antihistamine, an antibacterial, an antioxidant, a cancer preventative, an antispasmodic, an antiviral, an expectorant, a stimulant of the immune system, and a sedative of the mind, and a cure for hypochondria, not to mention monomania. But it is also supposed to be an anti-inflammatory. The last trait interests me most. Bruised leaves are prescribed for skin wounds, and birds do suffer skin irritation when they molt and new feathers push through their skin. Because this gill over the ground is easily bruised, I can imagine that flapping in it might release its cure-all chemicals. Well, that's my theory. Crows use medicinal plants in addition to medicinal ants. I float this balloon on a wildlife listserv I subscribe to, asking if any real scientist has heard of crows using medicinal plants. The silence is deafening, but I remember the similar response I got to my Orioles eating the apple buds, so you heard it here first. Reading on, I'm pulled back in time. Many of the weeds in my Freedom Lawn, I find, are European antiques. Settlers who couldn't imagine life without these herbs carried them to North America when they immigrated. The gill over the ground, in addition to its medical abilities, provided the flavoring for beer until hops edged it out. One of its many names, tun hoof, means tipple ivy. No wonder they brought it. People can withstand many privations, but teetotalism is a rare feature in human cultures. My lawn is a museum of useful European herbs. Besides gill over the ground, I have soapwort, which settlers use to condition new woven cloth, put a foamy head on beer, and wash the dishes. This I've got to see. I pick a stalk of the plant, which is conquering my flower beds, and rub a few leaves between my hands with warm water. Foam! The foam is green, and my hands are left smelling of leaf. But it's mild, and it works. Yellow-flowered celandine, another misery to keep out of gardens, was deployed against warts, liver disease, skin disease, ulcers, and cancer, I gather. Modern science suggests that many of those uses were justified, and a modified version of a celandine chemical is now produced as an anti-cancer drug. When I pick the plant, an orange latex oozes from the stem. I dab it on the flower book, where it hardens into a shiny dot. Having solved my crow-bathing mystery, to my own satisfaction at least, I turn my attention to the edible weeds in the lawn. My sheep sorrel, alyssum, and sow thistle are all recommended by weed eaters. The Freedom Lawn is organic, but I wash my harvest anyway. You never know if a squirrel has sat upon your greens. I also pick young raspberry leaves for tea, avoiding those obviously patronized by a slug who left silver slime behind. I carry my salad up to my office to make notes as I dine. Cheeky follows me and vacuums up sunflower seeds from the cup on my desk. His seed trafficking and my note typing are on a collision course. Not only does he add punctuation as he crosses the keyboard, he also drops seeds between the keys. When I bang the keyboard to clear things out, he scrambles to safety behind the computer. It's so touching when a wild animal trusts you. It's correspondingly irritating when he suspects you of attempted murder when you sneeze, run the printer, or clean the keyboard. We resume our respective meals. The sheep sorrel, which glitters like spinach, tastes like a green apple. I'd eat that for recreation. The hoary alyssum, on the other hand, is tough. It's a member of the mustard family, and it has a spicy bite. Maybe I should have cooked it. The sow thistle is a tall, spindly thing that looks like a cross between bolting lettuce and a dandelion. The arrowhead leaves have the delicate crunch of a young lettuce leaf and the bitterness of an older lettuce. Now I can't find it in any of my books. It's not sow thistle after all. The leaf is wrong. Nor is it wild lettuce. Whatever it is, it's tasty. Of course, the settlers didn't have to make do with their imported vegetables and weeds. They also had access to a new world of weeds here. Native yellow wood sorrel is one of my favorite nibbles. The clover-like leaves have a bright, sour flavor that vanishes so quickly that you want to eat another and another. My lawn is full of it. Sumac is another plentiful native in my yard. Yule Gibbons, the guru of weed-eating, recommended an Indian-inspired aid of crushed and strained berries. But the rose chafer beetles ate all mine this year, leaving me to speculate. Instead, I brew a tea from the black raspberry leaves. It's flavorless. Perhaps I'm supposed to be using the root, or perhaps I shouldn't be using it at all. In a volume called Iroquois Medical Botany, I find black raspberry prescribed for when a man is hunting and his wife is fooling around. It's also indicated for diarrhea and whooping cough. I'm not bothered by any of these at the moment. Native ragweed, which I have in abundance, the Iroquois used for skin infections and stings, stroke, and cramps from picking berries. I must keep that in mind. My old friend, Ten Petal, turns out to be a native chickweed, which the Iroquois employed against miscarriage. In fact, it's a challenge to find a native plant in my lawn that was not in the Iroquois medicine chest. They were even quick to exploit new plants the Europeans introduced. Plantain, the fibrous brute that rules my compacted driveway was adopted by Iroquois to treat the following ills: burns, sores, cuts, bleeding, bruises, spider bites, fever, sprains, bladder problems, nervous breakdown in overworked women, infertility, and arthritis. The English brought it by accident. In late summer, my lawnmower breaks. My Freedom Lawn goes extra feral and turns into a glorious thing. I get attached to it and don't ever want to mow it again. The plants that have endured decapitation every 2 weeks now raise their heads and bloom. They're stunted enough that the resulting prairie is about 6 inches high. A bonsai Queen Anne's lace produces a dwarf doily. The glossy item, whose leaf reminds me of marijuana, throws open brilliant yellow flowers. Microdaisies bloom at just 4 inches. Hoary alyssum sends up thin stems of white flowers, like rocket trails. The sheep sorrel makes an effort with gritty-looking red flowers. Ragweed is preparing to propagate in miniature, shoving up 2-inch spikes of nubby green blooms. Clover forms white clouds. A native St. John's wort unfolds yellow flowers. Even a couple of late-comer dandelions lift their tubes to blossom. The Freedom Lawn becomes a micro-meadow. I'm pleased, and my outdoor neighbors are too. Cheeky has better cover when he bounds from my house to his home with a cheekload of seeds. From the deck, he surveys his path for predators, then he leaps into the meadow, leaving stems quaking behind him. Big Fat Mama, my woodchuck, lies down and noshes on whatever's in reach. She reaches out a black paw to behead a dandelion, then lowers her head to snip a leaf. When she's harvested the best bits, she heaves to her feet and waddles a few steps before plopping down again. I can't tell if she's eating the native St. John's wort with her diuretic dandelions, and I find no scientific claim that the native, Hypericum punctatum, contains the same cheery chemical, hypericin, as the European version, Hypericum perforatum, but it makes me happy just watching Big Fat Mama graze through the herbs. The whole scene pleases me. My plain green lawn has turned into a tapestry. I'm amazed that all these flowers were able to wait out the tyranny of the lawnmower. But I suppose they wouldn't be living in my Freedom Lawn if they couldn't handle being whacked. As I get to know them, I learn that some propagate by sending underground runners, hawkweed. Others bloom and produce seeds below mower height, white clover. And some, like the dandelions, grow their buds flat on the ground until the last minute when they raise and open them. But I wonder if they're evolving even as they live here. I wonder if I and all the other Freedom Lawners aren't creating new strains of midget plants whose blooms never rise to meet the blade. When the mower comes back from the shop, I sigh and decapitate the wildflowers. But I do spare a patch. The apple stump is hard to mow around anyway, and I cut it a wider berth. I'm going to have a meadow 4 feet in diameter. The plants in this tuft surprise me. The grass matures into 3 different species, all more than 3 feet high. One is the cat-tail-headed timothy I recognize from the hayfields of my youth. Another produces seeds in 2 herringbone rows. The third dangles its seeds from threads, then tips over onto the lawn. Each grass turns brown at a different time. One day I look out to see that a goldfinch has forsaken the sack of thistle seed I offer. He's perched in the tall grass of the tuft, feeding on grass seed. The wildflowers go crazy. Creeping bellflower erects stalks of purple blossoms. Tenpetal flings itself into the upper echelon, propping itself on the grasses. In the middle is the prize. 2 sumac sprouts, their caterpillar green bark fuzzed in magenta velvet. Indians used sumac as a spice, I read, and to cure convulsions in children, bellyache in horses, and irregular menstruation. Depending on the ailment, they would scrape the bark up or down the branch. They even smoked the dry leaves. Sumacs are difficult to plant and spread best underground, as these have. I adore them. Nosing into the tuft, I see that others are finding what they want, too. A mouse, or perhaps Cheeky, has established a set of tunnels through the grass, all leading to a fresh hole excavated under the old stump. At the moment, the entry to this burrow is being used for a mating cave by a cricket. The tuft is turning into a micro-habitat. I start planning a whole series of tufts for next year's lawn. My tuft, though, could be in violation of South Portland law. Many towns have weed laws to deal with people like me. These ordinances generally forbid noxious weeds and stipulate a maximum height for turf. The usual rationale is that a long lawn gives shelter to snakes, rats, and man-eating tigers. But that's rarely what neighbors complain about. It's the way a wild lawn looks that grass farmers find irksome. It's the way weeds try to march out of the Freedom Lawn and into the manicured grass. As always, I'm as hypocritical as the next girl. One of my neighbors, an absentee landlord, has let her backyard go to Japanese knotweed, commonly known as bamboo. This plant has world domination on its mind. In the few weeks that my mower was broken, the bamboo pioneers on my side of the fence shot up 3 feet. Left to its own devices, the bamboo wilderness would invade and shade out my mini meadow. Big Fat Mama would find nothing to eat. The crows would take their medicine in some other yard. The goldfinches would go elsewhere for seeds and would nest elsewhere. The insects would come in swarms during the week that the bamboo blossomed, but would otherwise skedaddle. My yard would become a monoculture, and crawling from one end to the other would offer the allure of a ramble through a cornfield. Curious about the extremes of lawn culture and the lengths to which people will go to create a green carpet, I leave my yard again. This time I head for Arizona, a state designed to grow cacti and conifers, not thirsty grass plants. I'm not out of the Phoenix airport before someone is talking to me about water. The rental car clerk asks what I'm doing in town, then shakes his head. "I'm from L.A., he says. "I couldn't believe it when I saw the concave lawns down here. People flood 'em 4 or 5 inches deep and let it stand overnight. I thought a water main was broken." Something's broken, that's for sure. Phoenix receives 7 or 8 inches of rainfall a year. That's enough to grow cacti and deciduous plants that spend much of the year looking dead. I get about 6 times as much precipitation at home. But Phoenix is wall-to-wall green. From the window of an airplane, it looks like a patch of merry old England rolled out in the brown desert. Merry old England with palm trees. Up close and personal, some innovations become evident. Many homeowners have done some xeriscaping, replacing grass with cacti and other drought-tolerant species. But even more up close and personal, maybe this is not an improvement. Dr. Chris Martin studies the effect of the transition. I meet him at the Arizona State Center for Environmental Studies, which squats in a treeless 108-degree parking lot. Chris is a lanky guy whose wee, wry grin is a near-constant fixture. We climb into a truck and crank on the AC. Before air conditioning, no one gave a flip about xeriscaping, he says, pulling into traffic. The landscape around a house had a function. The trees had to provide shade. A yard had to cycle water to cool the air. But now, if your house is insulated to R20 or R30, shade doesn't matter. The landscape is now aesthetic. He pulls to the curb in front of one of those sunken lawns the rental car clerk mentioned. It's greener than my moist main yard in springtime. This yard, Chris explains, inherited an agricultural water allotment when farmland was divided into house lots. On a regular schedule, water flows from a canal into the yard. This yard sports fat trees, shrubs, and copious shade. Oranges have plonked into the street. These houses predate air conditioning, Chris notes. The trees were planted for shade. You'll also notice, as we go along, that there are lots of birds in these flood-irrigated yards. There are. It's cooler on the street, too, and less squinty bright. Not in evidence, however, are the redirected rivers, the Verde, the Green, the Colorado, that keep it all going. Every single plant that you're looking at here is being irrigated by flood, sprinklers, or drip irrigation, Chris says. If it weren't, it would all be dead in a couple of months. The big trees might take a year. There's a lot of water going into this system. This is the wet end of the spectrum of Phoenix lawns. We drive to Chris's own house to see a middling example. Chris's small front yard is xeriscaped, mainly with rocks. Around the edges of his large backyard are some desert plants, a green-skinned Palo Verde tree, a massive mesquite. A quail thrushes through the shrubbery. A vegetable garden withers in one corner. But the bulk of his acreage is in grass. I have 6 kids, he says. The 5 boys like to play football. So he waters. Now onward to a real xeriscape. Or is it a real xeriscape? Chris stops the truck at a mansion in the hills. Crushed stone paves the lawn. An Ocotillo cactus stretches slim arms toward the sky. The chubby barrel of a young saguaro rubs spines with a sprawling prickly pear. I think it looks terrific. It's a cartoon, Chris says. This is the landscape we call Disney Desert, small turf patches with irrigated desert plants. Because the fact is, no one wants to live in a desert. We've found that the longer a person lives here, the more they prefer green. Look, that's real desert. On the other side of the street, the houses end and nature begins. It's scruffy and brown. The sunlight flattens it into 2 dimensions. It's deadly boring to contemplate. Okay, I say, so if these people wanted a real desert, they could have creosote bushes and saguaros. One saguaro, Chris corrects, and not irrigated, so it's obese. Irrigated? But of course, says Chris, though the Greek root, xeri, and that's X-E-R-I, means dry, the industry that now flourishes under that name specializes in the illusion of dryness. Perforated hoses snake beneath most desert scapes, oozing water into the soil. The cacti stay fat, and the shrubs hold their leaves. Xeriscaping is not working at all if you look at it from the standpoint of water conservation, Chris concludes. If we did it well, we'd put the landscape maintenance industry out of business, and most of the people in that industry are low-income people. Do you want to put those people out of work? His ironic grin is cranked a little higher. Furthermore, he reminds me, the flood-irrigated neighborhood where we began our tour was cool and shady, wasn't it? That shade keeps the entire city a little cooler. And those water-hog trees, grasses, and shrubs cycle water much faster than desert plants do, and that evaporation cools the city even more. So which would you have, more water use and less air conditioner use, or less water use and more AC? A water shortage or fossil fuel smoke in the air? Chris chuckles. He has no easy answer. However, the university owns a plot of Phoenix houses and plans to landscape them 3 different ways to compare the effects. Not that Chris expects science to change anyone's mind about his or her lawn. I imagine, he says cheerfully, that we'll all waltz happily along and then we'll have a crisis. I say goodbye and head south through the desert and emerald green squares of irrigated corn to Tucson. At the other end of the extreme lawn spectrum, 2 brothers on a small urban lot are trying to live within the water budget that nature allotted to southern Arizona. Even though they grow food around their bungalow, Brad and Rod Lancaster still use less than 1/4 the water their neighbors consume. They could almost get by with the rain that falls on their soil and their roof, if they could bring themselves to chop down their sour orange tree. But we all draw the line somewhere. I have a hard time finding the house because it's behind a hedge of mesquite, fruit trees, and sickly-looking cacti. The gate, when I find it, is a sculpture welded from bike parts and tools, one of Rod's specialties. Over the hum of a Rod-made fan, the brothers are AC-free, Brad hears my knock and comes to the door. He kicks on sandals and slaps a hat over his blonde curls. It's even hotter here than in Phoenix. But Brad lifts his freckled nose to the wind and looks surprised. That smells like rain. It does, and it hasn't smelled like that for a long time. Tucson has been gasping from drought. This is the barest time in the garden, he apologizes. We let everything go dormant, and the chickens take over from April to July. Chickens. I spot a black one with a halo of chicks in the underbrush. It's not legal, Brad confesses, but we went to all our neighbors and asked them to give us a month. If the crowing didn't blend in with the dogs and birds in a month, we'd get rid of them. But no one has complained. Sharing the eggs with the neighbors probably softens the impact of the two roosters. Between eggs, cactus fruits, domesticated fruits, native seeds, and vegetables, the brothers produce between 15% and 25% of their food on this 1/8-acre lot. In addition, they produce some of their own power with a solar oven, solar water heater, and a solar electric panel. And they also produce water. Brad is writing a book on rainwater harvesting, and he's overflowing with statistics and sentences. You have to plant water before you plant plants, he says, quoting someone he met in Zimbabwe. He starts pointing out water traps all around me. The yard is sculpted into basins and troughs so that not one drop of rain rolls away. He pushes aside some tree branches and reveals a 1,200-gallon water tank on a pile of rocks. It collects all the water that runs off the house's roof. We move towards the back of the yard and find an outdoor shower, curtained with dry palm fronds. Instead of a single drain, it has three. Brad extends 1 foot to shift a rubber plug from one drain to another. Before, or even during your shower, you can decide which fruit tree to send your bath water to. Outside the yard, on the public right-of-way, the Lancaster brothers have been just as thorough. They've cut through the curb between their property and the street. Now when it rains, the runoff that usually runs down a storm drain is diverted into holding ponds. I don't ask, but I imagine these guys even direct their pee to this or that corner of the yard. Water is water. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We are reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.